third talk in the session. We'll be talking about MT bridging code that I've been working on with my colleague Michael Comer, Berkeley Lab. We'll get right to the chase here and introduce the objective function. We deal with ARM version code. We actually work with impedances, observe and predict it could be any component of the impedance tensor, and an appropriate data weight, which you've been achieved based on your estimates of the noise, as best you know. And then, of course, you add the stabilizer term here. In this case, we're looking for a smooth model constraint. There are many other forms you can use. So that's why, in the words of Al Dubin, used to call this process perversion. All keep in mind that we're looking at the Earth through a filter, our bias, okay? This lambda is the infamous trade-off parameter that trades off between the data misfit and the penalty term. And actually, when we set up this problem, we do not actually look for connectivity parameters, we do log parameters. As Andy has indicated, it's better to work with log parameters because it reduces the dynamic range and makes the problem a more linear. Go ahead.
Greg, is your data DJ or your error DJ, is that just a single scalar number for your...
You could make it a matrix if you wanted, but it's just a single scalar for each data point. Okay.
And so the real and imaginary parts are both assigned the same...
I'll get to that, but you have the flexibility of assigning different weights to the imaginary part of the real part. Now the objective is to minimize this cost functional, and sometimes it ends up minimizing your hopes. Because what you get out of an inversion process is what you put in, and sometimes you may not get enough information to make sufficient progress to get an answer that you like. But all we do is try. So basically, what approach we've adopted is to try to minimize that cost function with the minimum amount of work possible, given that we're going to be solving a very large three-dimensional inverse problem with millions, could be up to millions of parameters, and very large data sets. So this necessitated a very economical approach, and we adopted the non-conjugate gradient scheme that many of us use for 3D inversion. And to carry out this, we need two pieces of the cost function, the gradient cost function. We need the data part, and then we need the model part. In addition to these gradients, we also have to carry out a line search and minimize the cost function along the direction of t to determine the step scalar. Okay. So this is all well known in the optimization literature. I'm not going to go into it here. I would just say that we use the adjoint approach to efficiently compute the gradients. Doug has discussed that as well as Anna.
So this is well known.
The efficiencies of this algorithm, and I haven't really mentioned, we're also using this grid separation idea. So we separate the inversion grid from the simulation grid because this allows for very effective, fast simulations. Where the inversion grid is on a very fine parameterization level, and that's also embedded in the scheme. But to get to the chase, about computational cost besides optimal grids, the gradient requires four applications of the Ford curve at each frequency. An application corresponds to one MT source polarization at one frequency, meaning two to describe the impedance tensor at a different frequency. We also do carry out in the line search two more Ford modeling applications, and we need a total of, four per version update. And we have the algorithm implemented in a parallel framework, and we run it so the idea is to make an initial model guess, select a trade-off parameter based on a prior information that you have. Also, you could include a reference model in the process. And what we find is that during the iteration process, we like to actually reduce lambda as we go. This can help accelerate convergence. I know that to the theoretical optimization people, this is a no-no, but practically, we find out it works well, because when you start changing lambda with a descent sort of method, you violate previous gradient information, and that's used in the update, and that kind of changes the flavor of the algorithm. So what are you minimizing? Because you're changing the objective function. But I can tell you that from practical experience, it helps, and the results aren't so bad. Next slide. Now, for the Dublin test model, we went ahead and carried out an inversion with the synthetic results from the four calculations we presented yesterday. We started with 100 ohm meter half space. We considered all 9,012 data points on all components of the impedance tensor. This used all 21 frequencies at 59 detector locations. And for the data weighting, which we've commonly done with field data, is we pick the off-diagonal component of the impedance tensor to base our weights. In this example, we assume 5% weight, okay? And that we also apply to the on-diagonal components, because at the higher frequencies, these guys are effectively noise in this model. And we have to downweight them, or we won't make any progress. And so, but as the frequency lowers, these guys become more important, and this weighting then will still allow us to get information of this data into the imaging process.
That should be ZYX in the bottom right. That.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, correct. We just chose 5%. I mean, you can choose many different tests, but basically, this is what we went with. We saw we had a lot of.
Was that done on a like a station by station?
Station by station. I took it at each station. I looked at the magnitude of the particular off-diagonal component of the impedance tensor, and then assigned the data weight for that component and its sister on-diagonal component like that. Okay. So the problem, after we parameterized the problem, we had about 10 million resistivity parameters to image, and we ran this on 64 cores. However, if we were to do all 21 frequencies in parallel, here we're doing it one frequency at a time, this problem we've actually solved on 3,720 cores.
Which can, next slide,
can greatly speed things up. And I was desperate to get results in time for this workshop, and so I went ahead and did it. So this is a test model. We're going to try to invert, just to remind yourself. You can go to the next slide. Again, coordinate systems are important, because the results I'm going to present are in my coordinate system, not yours. But you can affect this coordinate rotation if you want, and you'll be happy. So, next slide. Now, I'm going to plot some inversion metrics of this for the Dublin test model. First of all, the first graph is a plot of iteration versus the objective function with the penalty term and the data misfit. And then the second, which I find much more useful, is a percentage data error measure. And this tells us what percent of the data are we hitting, okay? So when we started out the first iteration, we're up fitting about 50% of our data. And this includes data weights in it, okay? And as we iterate, down to around iteration 40, we're fitting to about, in this case, I believe it was 2.3% of our data. We're fitting all our data except 2.3%, okay, of the weighted data. So you can say, well, that's pretty good. But you can go to the next slide. I'll show you what the fits look like for that level of fit. Now we're going to be looking at just this profile across the center of the structure here, okay? So this is the Z, Y, X apparent resistivity fits. This is the calculated response for the frequency over the profile, and this is the features in the data for this polarization, next slide. For the ZXY apparent resistivity fits, you see that we're starting to indicate resistive material here with the data. You can do the comparison. Next slide. This is the phase for ZYX. Observers, it's calculated. And then the Z, next slide, please. The ZXY. And what you'll notice is that this shows the poorest fit, where we're not able to recover this drop in phase of about 41 degrees here with the calculated response. And this is fitting about 98% of our data. We're still not able to get this data. So I went back and decided, I didn't like this feature here because there was a lot of research structure in the model. So I went back and we started the inversion of a larger regularization parameter and dropped the error even further. Next slide. When I did that, this is a data fit now at 1.8%. So we're fitting the fit. That's right. Really pushing it. Yeah, really push it hard to get it. So we're fitting more than 98% of our data. And finally, we're starting to see that the data structures and the longer periods emerge, but you really have to beat on it. It doesn't come out right away. And I'll show you the model now.
Excuse me, Greg, when you say that you think 98% of the data, what does that mean?
We'll go back to the misfit curve. Keep going back. Sorry. Oh, one more. Sorry. This measure here, okay, this is the measure of the data error divided by the observed weighted data, okay, multiplied by 100%, okay? So if we fit our data perfectly, this is zero, this can never be, all right? So, but if we fit it to 99%, then this measure is just like we're fitting our observed to our predicted data to 1%, and the squared measure, squared norm, okay? That's all that science. And it includes the data weights.
So when you say it fits 98% of the data, that doesn't mean that 98% of the data are fit to within plus or minus one standard deviation.
No, it's just based on this metric. Okay. You're just taking the sum of squares of error, dividing by your weighted observed data, multiplying by 100%. So that tells us how close you're fitting.
And if you have a Gaussian, if you have Gaussian random variable, what should the expected value of that be?
I haven't looked at that. I can't say at this point.
This is just a tool because it's very hard looking at this raw objective function to regularize what that means. Okay. All I'm saying is that to really make any progress with this model, you really have to drive it down. And you made a comment earlier about John Booker where you really have to beat on it, or have a very good idea of what the model you're looking for to make progress. Otherwise, you need to be very patient.
I'm going to discuss this a little bit tomorrow with regard to how poor a measure of chi-square or some chi-square equivalent is, because what can often happen is you can overfit the bore. With this smoothness regularization, you can overfit the boring bits of the Earth and underfit the parts of the Earth where action. I think that's the case here, that you're actually forcing it. You're going below the 5% error.
That's correct.
You're saying that 5%, I'm forcing
it. I didn't get anything I liked. I really had to drive it. So that's an issue that we need to discuss at depth, because I've noticed for the MP problem, it's much more slower to converge than the controlled source. Okay, so let's go and show you the image. This is the image that in cross section. This starts at minus 15 kilometers in my y coordinate, zero right over the body, and 15. And what we see is clearly the top of the 10-ohm-meter dike structure shown here, and some indication of this deeper conductor here. But we have really no clear indication of the deeper resistor. Okay.
There's not much response to the resistor in the data anyway. So.
similar issue that Anna brought up, and I didn't like it because it was putting too much structure under the detector, so I went back and upped the regularization parameters you had suggested, Randy, and that tended then relaunched the inversion that seemed to take care of the near surface problems. So strictly from the source of the point of view is that I didn't like the variability in the near surface of the conductivity image, and I decided that was not a good choice for the regularization parameter. We needed to go back and redo the inversion with a larger value, and then that seemed to produce a more acceptable, pleasing result. But I do want to point out is that one of my philosophies in inversion is I really do not like to, filter the gradients or do things to try to activate the deeper parts of the model space. You need to be very careful because when you do that, you sometimes can activate parts of the model space that really don't have all that much influence on your data. It's a very dangerous game, okay? And also sometimes you do need that near surface sensitivity to deal with the issue of static shifts. Go to the next slide. Because static shifts is my philosophy is my point of view that static shifts should be removed from, or should be estimated within the inversion process in the conductivity structure in the near surface. If you go ahead and you damp out your gradients because you don't like this near surface variability, that could adversely impact you in getting a good estimate of removing the static shift from your data. Now, there are other ways to do this by estimating static shift parameters, and I'd be very interested to talk about this, but there's a trade-off here. So you do want to have near surface sensitivity to deal with the static shift problem if you want to remove that from your data from the inversion process. So you need to talk about that. The other is survey aperture and station density. That's very important. And then model stabilization issues. And these are some of the topics we should discuss tomorrow because they're very critical.
Well, it's a bit more complicated than static shifts if you have a galvanic distortion, a 2x2 distortion, then you multiply the 2x2 distortion wheel with the 2x2 complex. And so you're actually getting loading. Most of the time you're okay because the diagonals are small enough that you can treat it as a straight static. As Marion showed yesterday, if you have these inclined conductors, you're going to get large diagonal turns, and just thinking of it static shifts is wrong. It's you're getting load, you're getting impedance mixing when you multiply them 2x2 value.
So
you've got to solve for the falling galvanic distorter and the earth at the same time.
Yeah. Well, my point of view is let's find a conductivity model that puts structure underneath your detectors that will make the adjustments or produce the static shifts you see in your observed data. But the danger in that is that you have a very high sensitivity to the near surface. So you've got to, there's a trade-off here, okay? The other issue I'd like to talk about tomorrow is station density. Clearly, if you're doing a regional basin scale imaging experiment, you're not going to want to have empty stations every 300 meters, okay? And so you're going to be dealing with a much coarser station density. How does that impact your detailed images of the near surface? This will produce a very blocky structure if you're trying to remove static shift. For some stations will be affected by static shift. Is that acceptable? That sort of issue.
I think generally, Greg. I think generally in MT with unsampled, we've got an approach to seismic type where you're putting down hundreds and hundreds of sensors, primarily in some cases like that as well.
Correct. But then, all right. Then, if you're with the philosophy of let's try to estimate the static shift through near surface conductivity variations, that's going to lead to a very patchy near surface model. Okay, it's not very pleasing or geological when you look at it. Okay, so that's it. And I just make a comment about the solution times. On the 64 core example, it was taking about 7 hours per inversion iteration. When we ran it on over 3,000 cores on NERSC, we're getting about 20 minutes in inversion update. So anyways, that's my philosophy.
5 minutes.